We're going to start the program with a little snapshot of Alberta Street to look at the role that gentrification also plays in changing the culture of our communities. And we'll sort of probably be touching a little bit on that, like sort of as we create more cultural institutions and create more of a cultural fabric throughout the city, how do we avoid certain aspects of gentrification which drive out certain segments of the population? But anyway, we're going to take a little quick look at Alberta Street, and this is a feature produced by Julie Sabatier, who is one of the interns in the whole community radio project.
Do you cast Americanos?
You know, years ago when I first come in here in 72, we had all the same things, but it was taverns rather than lounges. People nowadays, especially the younger people nowadays, they just like coffee. They drink that espresso coffee like it's 40 gone north, you know.
That's Joseph Benjamin. His is one of the last of the old taverns left on Alberta Street in northeast Portland. After 33 years, Joe's place is closing its doors so that Benjamin can retire and lease out the space. He has watched 3 decades of change on Alberta Street. 30 years ago, it was one of the commercial centers of Portland's African American community. But by the early 80s, it was a street where no one felt safe, and many of the businesses were closed.
The only thing I could say that I did differently, I hung on longer than the other. A lot of things that really, really tore this neighborhood up when they started gangbanging around here. And that's what really made it bad. A lot of the people sold out. I was just determined that I wasn't going to run.
This very intersection on 14th Place was like the number one intersection for drive-by shootings 10, 15 years ago.
Jeanette Caden and her business partner opened the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Alberta Street 4 years ago in a location formerly occupied by Rosalind's Coffee Garden, one of the first businesses that opened 12 years ago, awakening a renaissance on Alberta Street.
I don't really see any crime anymore, and that's good. Vacant, vandalized, boarded-up buildings are now vibrant living businesses and residences and art galleries.
Portland is a very segregated town, and this is the black part of town, or at least it was, and it used to be that white folks were not necessarily welcome here, and then something changed.
Video animator and artist Zach Margolis has lived in the Alberta neighborhood for several years.
Some poor sort of white artists start moving in because it's a place that they can afford, and they start making it safe for people with a little bit more money to come in. One thing leads to another, and suddenly it's a place that's not affordable anymore.
Some of the most visible artists in the neighborhood live in the Clown House, just up the street from Joe's place. Caffeine Jones is one of the clowns who says she hardly recognizes the street just 2 years after moving in.
I came back here to raise my daughter in this area because I wanted her to grow up with the perspective that I grew up with. I wanted her to have a lot of different people around her, you know, and not just like sort of one type of person, or live in a kind of neighborhood where everybody in the neighborhood has, you know, the same income level or whatever. And it's just disappearing.
The neighborhood has changed. It has definitely gentrified.
Christy Pearson Dunning was a part of a buying club that became the Alberta Street Food Co-op.
When we bought our house 17 years ago, it was $32,000. Now, the houses on our street are selling for $250,000, $300,000. All the poor people are being driven out of the neighborhood unless they own their homes. And the people who started the buying club basically were part of the, for lack of a better word, the gentrification of this neighborhood. It was a bunch of Caucasian sort of hippies. And that's not what this neighborhood was originally.
Dingo the Clown, a longtime Clown House resident, offers one possible solution.
As soon as I heard our rent was going to go up, I was going to go get a whole bunch of macadamia nuts and put them in little baggies and just strew them all over the neighborhood. Maybe turn it back into a crack neighborhood, because then it'd be affordable. But I think that's illegal.
It's not just us. It's not just affecting us, but all over Portland and in a lot of other cities too, there's this move toward sort of cleaning up these inner city areas.
The relative merits of such cleanup projects is a hot topic of debate along Alberta Street.
This whole neighborhood is becoming extremely white, just like the rest of Portland.
Aisha Khazul recently opened Zaytuna, a bar that also serves Lebanese
coming
food
up late
in a brand new building
cable
at 22nd
at Barbara Bernstein hosts.
She says graffiti on the walls of the new place let her know what people thought right away.
Someone had sprayed yuppie scum,
and all of that. Now, people don't know anything about me. They don't know I'm from Iraq. They don't know that the owner of the bar is a woman. Some people don't know that. They don't know that I'm a lesbian. They don't need to know anything about my background. They simply know that I'm opening a bar in Alberta, and they don't like it. And because of that, they're not going to like me. I am part of gentrification, and I don't like that, but I am a part of it.
The clowns have heard a lot of people complain about them, mostly anonymously, for bringing the first wave of gentrification to Alberta Street.
Somebody actually said, why don't you go to Tacoma and raise their property values?
There may be people on Alberta Street who don't like living and working next door to circus performers, but many people feel they bring a much-needed creative element to the changing culture of the street.
What made the street so memorable and really give it its character is the Clown House. That, to me, is what defined Alberta. That, to me, is why I came to Alberta, because of people like Dingo and his friends who are so amazing to watch and so talented. And they're being pushed out.
As the first wave of new residents starts to feel uncomfortable, many are speculating about what the street will look like in another 5 or 10 years. Zach Margolis.
It seems like it's inevitable that eventually it's going to turn into a Hawthorne or a Northwest 23rd or a Belmont.
It feels like community here. Like you go to Northwest 23rd and it's somehow void of any human heart and character. And I think Alberta still has that.
Joseph Benjamin says he feels like the business community was much more close-knit when the street was lined with taverns.
I remember back in the days when, like, if I had a real slow night, I'd have 4 or 5 of my regular customers in here. Hell, we'd close up and go down to one of the bars down the street. I knew every owner from Martin Luther King to 29th. And we had a lot of fun back then. It isn't like that anymore.
While old-timers like Joseph Benjamin feel that the community they knew and felt a part of has disappeared, the neighborhood is in flux, and a new kind of community is forming among the current residents and business owners.
People seem to know each other and recognize each other and make that effort and go out of their way to get to know who their neighbors are. And that is amazing. That's why the city is not a city. It's a big town, you know, or a gigantic village.
For the Whole Communities Radio Project, this is Julie Sabatier.
And now I'm here in the studio with Bill Bulick and Steve Johnson, and we're hoping, actually, Kristen Aspen is on her way down, and she'll be here shortly. So good morning, Steve and Bill.
Good morning.
Actually, I was thinking we'll be talking in broader terms today about the role that cultural development plays in creating sustainable, healthy communities around Portland and hopefully around the nation. But I was just thinking of one of the last lines in Julie's piece about how Alberta Street will possibly be turning into a Northwest 23rd or Hawthorne Boulevard. And I want to start, Bill, with your cultural roots back at Artichoke Music, actually, when it was over on Northwest 21st, and shortly after you went on to other things, that store moved to Hawthorne, actually.
When Hawthorne was beleaguered.
Right.
So and it moved there essentially for cheap rent and access to Southeast residents.
And I think that that's something we can sort of look at those migration patterns as we're kind of looking at what cultural development brings, because I think that one of the upsides of cultural development, when you watch a street like Alberta be transformed from a community of empty storefronts and drive-by shootings to a place where there's a lot of art galleries and there's coffee houses and there's a lot of music and there's a whole sense of community. And I don't think that Hawthorne was ever quite as derelict as Alberta was until the recent years. But certainly at the time when Artichoke Music moved over to Hawthorne, it was just beginning to be a real vibrant business community. And so it's one of the things we can think about through this morning's discussion is how do we prevent these communities from going to the next stage of gentrification. First it's the artists, and then it's the rich people, and then the artists, and not only the artists, but the original residents of the community are kind of forced out. So actually, Bill, since this program was your idea, it kind of grew out of a conversation that Bill and I had last spring at a reception for Coalition for the Livable Future, who's the partner for this project, the Whole Community Radio Project. Bill came up to me and was looking at the brochure for our series and said, this is really great, but you're missing something about culture. And so that inspired me to put the show together. So I thought we could start by having Bill explain how do you see culture as being, or cultural development as being, a real key component of creating healthy and sustainable communities?
Well, if we take the the usually accepted definition of sustainability as incorporating and expressing the linkages between economic development and environmental stewardship and social programs. There are lots and lots of linkages in terms of how cultural development supports those values, but underneath it all is the sense that it really is our value system that is about wanting to take care of each other, take care of the earth, that underlies all of that, and which is expressed in a variety of ways culturally. So we have, you know, we have artists that are doing work that is about environmental stewardship and about social issues, and we have culturally based economic development. So there are many kinds of links that we have, but underneath it all is just a sense of about taking care of each other and taking care of the earth and creating a place in which all who live here get to participate in the fruits of living here, and that is a culturally generated and transmitted value.
Well, I think for a lot of people, the idea of cultural development is to create cultural institutions and cultural centers. And actually, you were kind of involved with this too back a number of years ago when the Portland Center for Performing Arts was created. And there was a split at that time about should we be putting all of our cultural resources and trying to get funding for this big thing downtown, or should we be focusing more on really helping to develop grassroots cultural community, grassroots community culture throughout the city. And I'm sort of curious about what you're looking back now, because I don't know how many years ago, it was 20 years ago at least, or more, that you were involved with that bond
right.
measure. Would you, where you're coming from now, put as much energy into creating a Center for the Performing Arts? Do you think that that plays an equally vital role as a lot of the little community cultural centers that have sprung up all around Portland?
Well, I don't have a problem with investing in major cultural facilities, but I do think that it's critical that it be balanced with investment in smaller scale diffuse network of cultural activity, and that that's really what creates sustainable neighborhoods and sustainable culturally based economic development. And looking back on my own involvement in this, I think I and others put too much bandwidth into those issues, and those issues became such difficult political issues that they kind of used up all our time and energy and money.
Those issues referring to what?
To development and then ongoing funding for downtown performing arts facilities. They're important, but to the extent that they blind us to other opportunities, It's too bad.
Well, one of the things that I think drew a lot of people to Portland, actually of our generation, we're those of us who are over 50 and have been around since the early 70s, at least, if not before that. I think Steve Johnson's been around for a few generations, a few centuries down there in Johnson Creek. But that one of the things that was very attractive about Portland, and I think still remains attractive, is the amount of grassroots culture that has just seems to be generated by the rain, perhaps, whatever it is. And I remember when I came here in 1971, one of the institutions that really struck me was Storefront Theater, which in those days was over a funky little storefront on Russell Street down near Interstate, and a place that was heated by a wood stove, and you brought your own means to keep warm in the winter, and in the summer you brought a lot of paper to fan yourself with. But there were some really incredible, innovative performances. Later on, Storefront moved downtown and actually started becoming part of the Performing Arts Center. And I was actually participated in one of their performances, one of the last performances of Storefront Theater. It was actually killed by trying to keep up with the need to generate revenue to be able to afford to be in the Performing Arts Center. But I'm thinking, Steve, that you were involved with a lot of, or at least some kind of countercultural institutions back in your youth. And I want to talk a little bit about what they were and how that helped to create the culture that we have in Portland that's not just, not just the continuing kind of counterculture, but also how that's sort of mutated into a more mainstream culture as well.
I think here's one of the mysteries of the day is Portland is the fastest growing city outside of the Sun Belt in America right now. And if you think about that, given our 30 days of rain in a row, why are people coming here? Why is this influx of cultural creatives coming to Portland? It's not because of Las Vegas story, which is, you know, get wealthy, glamour. You come here for what? I think you come here because of the cultural institutions. I think places like KBOO have had a huge influence on who comes to Portland because there's a myth about the life in Portland. And I think it's had a lot to do with the culture, much more than the business chamber of commerce. I think the cultural institutions have spread a rumor, at least, nationwide and beyond, that there's a place to come where people care about the environment, where there's an entrepreneurial aspect to life here. And I think back in those days, what I was remembering before coming here was, we touched on it, and the Alberta piece did too, how important what are called third places have been in that. Darcel's Cafe Espresso House, and which was across the street from the Spaten House, where the Civic Auditorium is, and the first, those were the early institutions where people gathered. Without those gathering places, you know, the revolution never happens. And I think it's just been very important that those kind of entrepreneurial cafes, bars, Mountain Moving Cafe was another one.
Right, yeah.
You know, those are very instrumental places. It's where you got together, as KBOO did virtually over the air. People can come, they come to town. I hear that story constantly. Well, I go to KBOO. You know, they come from somewhere else. They come here and go, here's my community.
Well, I'm remembering an event a long time ago that Barbara and I were both involved in that actually KBOO was a sponsor of, which was the World Music Festival, mm-hmm. which was at a sort of ahead of its time in terms of a celebration, a multicultural celebration of music and art and dance, but was, I think, an expression of how things happen in Portland, is that we could see, those of us involved, that our city was changing and there was a mixing of more cultures, and we wanted to do something to reflect that. It was a very grassroots effort that put that together, and it expressed grassroots culture. It gave the opportunity for us to see how our city was changing and how the different cultures would express themselves.
But you and I were talking about that informally, about how I think right now, given the civic discourse that's around in our community, that's, I think, fallen somewhat around certain political issues like Oregonians in Action, et cetera, and the role that arts and culture could play in that. I think sometimes the political dialogue right now needs infusion from the other side of the brain, the other hemisphere. Some, you know, in other words, we're not reaching those roots. And partly it's because Oregon and Portland in particular has diversified. It's one of the most, it's not diversified, but it's one of the most diversifying communities in the country right now, which puts you under stress to build a civic story that we all have in common. And I think it's the role culture and arts has to play right now is to come in. Politicals aren't going to play it. I mean, I mm-hmm. love Potter's Vision Committee, but I don't think it's got enough. Is that the right brain? You know what I mean? It doesn't have enough of the humanist side to say, no, we need something more like the World Music Festival. We need something that's more creative in terms of bringing people together to express their common humanity. And what is it to live in Portland? And not right. someone's outside view of, hey, you guys saved this for us. Now we can develop it. You know, which is what I see people coming in and saying, oh, this is cool. But if you could just do away with the rules now, then we could really go hog wild. You know? Well, no, that's not the way it works.
Well, I was remembering like 30, 40 years ago that in Portland, the power structure was still kind of the timber baron. It was sort of the holdover from the timber barons. And it was the power structure in Portland and throughout most of Oregon was very conservative. Mm-hmm. And kind of these few white rich guys, and they were basically still wanting to keep it all for themselves. And I think in the early 70s, we saw this tension between the timber baron mentality and these hippies that were coming. Either some of them were homegrown, like Steve here, and some of them were coming from other places, like myself. And that there was I think in the beginning, at least my experience of being a hippie in Portland in the early 70s, was we created our own institutions. Who cared about the opera? Who cared about... Actually, I did go to the ballet, discovered that that was not too bad. It wasn't Portland Ballet, but, you know, there were some things that came in that were kind of cool to go to. But Portland was not exactly noted for having a world-class orchestra, opera, or ballet back in the early 70s. I'm not sure it's noted for that even at this point. But the grassroots culture was phenomenal, the folk culture. I mean, there was an amazing folk scene here. There was a burgeoning jazz scene. And there was an awful lot of new stuff, like the places where country music and old-timey music and folk and rock were all coming together, and a lot of that was happening here. And it was a very exciting place to be from the outside culture as opposed to the inside culture. I think that after a while, there became a tension between how do we redefine Portland, and it was the new mentality, the countercultural mentality. It seemed like, well, it took over the state legislature. We got the bottle bill and land use laws. I mean, there's a whole change in tenor politically in Oregon in the 70s, which I think came from an infusion of a whole new way of thinking. It may be that we need that now. I think that the way that Oregon is perceived as the power structure is us, in a way. It may not be the reality, but I think it appears that way. And we have to look now, if we are, in fact, the power structure, and Tom Potter, in a way, represents the us kind of thinking, how do we start including all these other people that are the newer generation of people who come to Oregon, who are way more diverse culturally, I think, than we were in the 70s? And how do, and as Steve was saying, how do we find a way for the Oregon story to include them as well?
My sense, having come here in the early 70s and been involved in community activism since then, is that Portland was and is a peculiarly open civic culture. I don't actually think the old white guys were as opposed to change as some might think they were. I mean, they in many ways they participated in change. It was a more moderate conservatism at that time, and very grounded in some sense of stewardship of place. And so change could happen, and people could get involved, and they could get involved creating their own institutions, but they could also run for city council. And they remarkably, they still can. And so I think there's great hope for change. You know, we have stronger tensions and conflicts around certain issues now. And I think cultural expression can help us not only to open up a community dialogue about issues that we care about, like land use is a great example, but can point the way towards some options, some new ways of thinking about how we steward our place and how we take care of each other.
I think in terms of those, the white, who was in charge back in that time, I used to hang out in downtown with my mom, who helped start the Portland Teachers Credit Union. We'd go out to lunch with the downtown business guys in the 50s when I was a little kid. These were guys that wore bow ties and had stains on their old tweed coats. And, you know, they shopped and did 99% of their economic transactions probably within 5 miles of downtown Portland. Hilaire's, other people that all hang out at Huber's, right? So in that sense, those people as downtown businessmen were shopping locally. They were locally grown and shopping. You know, what's changed, I think, is the outside investment, really. We mm-hmm. have less control over our future than we did in those days. So in the early 70s, we could innovate, we could do all kinds of things, and everybody just looked at us like, whatever. I mean, you know, we just had the death with dignity mm-hmm. Approved by the Supreme Court, but in those days, we could have done whatever we wanted to, nobody paying attention to Oregon. You know, it's like...
Now we're in the national news.
Now we're in the national right. news, but also there's people right. that are outside. You know, you go to a meeting now at land use, and you look around, and I remember years ago looking around the room once going, I don't know anybody here. Who are these people? And I realized it was a team of lawyers from an outside developer, you know. So it's, I think in that sense, the power structure has changed. But the boomers are in charge right now. And I think it's, when you look at that period that I researched, only less than 20% of the civic groups exist today that exist in, say, 1960. We, as young baby boomers, were not let in the doors, the city club, whatever, all the institutions would not let the young long hairs in the doors. So we went out and created our own institutions. I would challenge right now that we may be at that same point. Young people, newcomers, and outside challenge groups may be saying, boomers, make room, or else we're going to mm-hmm. displace you.
Well, just a small example, but getting back to the community visioning process that's going to unfold now, which I think is good timing for us to take stock. I was really heartened to learn that there are grants actually to community-based institutions to create public dialogue type efforts, and that the criteria are pretty open. So we have actually an opportunity for artists and community activists to get involved and actually receive some funding to diffuse the whole process of public dialogue and do it in more creative ways. So
actually, we're looking, this project is going for funding under that. So, I mean, it might be a way of keeping this project alive as well. I want to let people know that you are listening to KBOO Portland listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock, and this is the whole community's radio project here on Locust Focus. We're talking today about the role that cultural development plays in creating and sustaining healthy communities. My guests are Bill Bulick and Steve Johnson. Bill is a longtime arts development consultant and also arts administrator, and as I like to keep remembering, the founder of Artichoke Music, which I think we could talk about that also as a kind of culture institution that has really transformed Portland in a lot of healthy ways. Steve Johnson, if we want to go way back, you were the editor of Rain Magazine. Is that correct?
Yes, and not only that, but also worked on Portland Scribe in the days when Portland Scribe and KBOO were intimately connected over on Belmont.
Right, across the street from each other, actually.
Yes.
In fact, I remember the KBOO news department actually got started, the first news department got started in the basement of the Scribe office.
Right.
And in the Artichoke days, and I need to correct that I was not a founder of Artichoke Music. I came in at a certain point, and it was a wonderful organization to be involved with. I now often tell the story. I learned everything I needed to know about running a nonprofit organization by essentially having this music store that was in effect a community center. But I did a show on KBOO for quite a few years during those years as well.
Right. I mean, actually, I think KBOO, I mean, I don't want to toot our own horn too much, but I think KBOO has played a real important role in defining and shaping a unique culture here in Portland, and hopefully, I mean, I had to go down to Dallas last night to give a presentation, and I was able to listen to KBOO all the way down to Dallas, which was kind of pleasant. And our signal was not quite that good in 1971,
No, there was Portland Scribe would issue a little bulletin almost every week and say, KBOO is now on the air. It would feel like that was the news.
Oh, KBOO is you can hear KBOO now.
Right.
East of 82nd Street.
Right.
And Kristen Aspen Knapp is now here. Waking
Thank
up.
You.
Yes.
Wide
yes.
awake, I could tell.
And, I kept looking for that outline of what we were going to talk about to remind me.
We're talking about the role that cultural development plays in creating healthy and sustainable communities. And what inspired me to invite Kristen to this panel, at the end of the summer, my band played at this Parks concert at Tualatin Commons. And I have to admit that when Kristen offered us a gig at Tualatin, we laughed. And I thought, Tualatin Commons, I hadn't been there in a while, but when I had been to Tualatin Commons sometime in the 80s, it was this artificial lake, and there was one office building, and I thought, I wonder what it's going to be like to play here. I had no idea what had happened. So we get to Tualatin Commons that day. It's this very vibrant little business community. I mean, in my opinion, it could be a model for suburban development. Lots of very interesting looking places and a ton of people.
Public art pieces.
There were ducks and waterfowl in the artificial lake, so even they are making a home. And this very lovely little plaza area, kind of like Pioneer Square with a lake. Pioneer Square by the lake. And then all these people came, and it was one of the most wonderful gigs I've ever played. And Kristen told me afterwards that it was the Parks concerts that have really helped to generate community there. So I mean, Kristen's been producing Parks concerts for years, mostly starting in Portland, and I guess now spreading out to Tualatin and the outlying areas.
25 years.
Wow.
I've been doing this. Developing the concept, I think, of neighborhood Parks concerts. And yeah, I was listening to you as I was driving in talk about mountain moving and the way that the institutions that we created in the 70s have provided the underpinnings for what's going on now. And certainly my connection to Mountain Moving Cafe and the whole cultural milieu of the 70s in which we really created institutions that served our needs. And I'm talking about myself, baby boomers. I'm 57. And I was just out of college.
We were hippies.
We
right?
were hippies, yeah. We were hippies. Even then, we didn't know we were hippies. We were hippies. What I do now with the parks and began doing, first of all, I started out with the city had money to put into these concerts, and they gave me a budget, and I put it together. And then suddenly there was no money. About 7 years later, I started in 1980 with producing the concerts for Portland Parks and Recreation. And then 7 years later, there was no money. And I said, well, you know, this is really a shame. There's no money, and all of a sudden we're going to have no concerts because of that. Because in seven, eight years, people had come to really enjoy the concerts, and I could see that it was an organizing tool in a way. It was a way to reach the neighborhoods and talk to people and have them participate by working with me to put on the concerts. And I said, we just have to strengthen this in such a way that the communities in which the concerts are located can support them from the businesses that are located in those neighborhoods. So I really started to develop the committees and asked them to use their contacts with businesses in the neighborhood to get sponsorships to do it. And it has just blossomed and been fabulous and grown and grown and grown. And people who get on the committees are so excited, and they love doing it, and they meet each other in their neighborhoods. So it really brings people together in the neighborhoods. It gives them a sense of ownership and place. You know, I live here. Mount Tabor is my park. It's my concert series. Fern Hill Park is just now developing a committee that's very excited. It's wonderful to do that. And Tualatin, yes, Tualatin was very new at that time, and I knew the parks director, and he knew the work that I had done in Portland. And so he called me and said, do you think we could do something like that out here? And, you know, there was nothing there.
Any buildings out at that point?
There was, like you said, one or two. And, you know, they were talking about putting a building up on this one little bit of grass that was still there. They had planted it in seed just as a sort of stopgap until they built a building there. And after we had the first concerts and everybody sat on the grass to listen to the concerts, I said to Paul, you know, I don't think we should put a building there. What do you think? And he said, well, maybe not. You know, maybe we keep that. So it's stayed as grass, and it's the one green spot around that lake. And I think that Tualatin is very happy with how that's developed. It's been 13 years now.
Now, you said to me last summer that, in fact, the concert series had a whole lot to do with really creating community in Tualatin. I wonder if you can talk more about that.
Well, I'm not as aware in Tualatin of how and if that's true. I know that that's true in Portland Parks because I am involved with the various neighborhood committees that do it. In Tualatin, it is less of a community put on. The community doesn't participate as much in putting it on. I really work with the Parks Department directly to select the artists and do all that. But in Portland Parks, we have neighborhood committees that listen to all the music, choose the music that they want for their parks after they raise the money. You know, they find out how much money they have, then they figure out what groups they want. And so I just facilitate that in Portland, and that I'm very proud of because I really feel that that means the community is in charge and in control and making this their own series.
Well, we're talking today about the role that cultural development plays in sustaining healthy communities and how it's certainly played out here in Portland. And we're talking kind of about cultural development in general, as well as remembering the old days of the countercultural development that happened 25, 30 years ago and how it's kind of become more part of the mainstream cultural fabric of Portland. If you want to join the conversation, the number to call is 503-231-8187. I'm joined by Steve Johnson, Kristen Aspen, and Bill Bulick, who have all played very strong roles in shaping the culture here in the Portland area. And again, you can join in the conversation. Give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 12 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, that was a great piece by Julie Sabatier about Alberta Street earlier. And I was speaking of the cultural development of Alberta Street. I lived there for 15, almost 16 years. the funny thing is there's like an inexplicable community of clowns that live in the Alberta Arts District. I mean, you got Shoehorn Conley, My Sweetheart, Leapin' Louie Lichtenstein. There's been Tash West, whose character is Mildred Hoediddle, and even members of the Flying Karamazov family live in the Alberta Street Arts District, if you know who they are. And but I wanted to point out some of these issues, like what Julie raised in her pre-recorded piece, looking at gentrification on Alberta Street. It's a little ashamed that you don't have any panelists there today who are African-American, because there's been layers of gentrification on Alberta Street through the decades. I mean, and when they talk about the owner of Joe's Place finally closing down his bar, I mean, if you talk to African-American people who are from that neighborhood, there's a bitterness about what used to be a really vibrant club scene, and it was black-owned, family-owned taverns. And there's a sense in the black community specifically that throughout the 1980s and into the 90s that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission deliberately targeted those businesses to find violations and shut them down purposely, really just for straight-up racist reasons, which is just interesting and part of where some of the bitterness comes from. And just recently, we've seen stories in the Willamette Week, I think the Oregonian as well, with an Oregon Liquor Control Commission official making racist comments in the media about what do hip-hop club owners expect is going to happen and stuff like that. These issues of racism in the OLCC have actually had an impact on that neighborhood, which is pretty intense. But I was going to say, layers of gentrification, you know, back in the 80s, you know, the state government started to systematically shut down these businesses. And then in the 90s, you did sort of see clowns moving in, which is a little embarrassing, but it's true. Fact, deal with it. And now almost all the businesses on Alberta Street are owned by women. I think the statistic is something like 90%. It's huge. And the thing I think that's having the biggest impact on development and cultural development on Alberta Street right now is the role of the Portland Development Commission. They give most of the small business loans that people take out to open those little coffee shops and dress shops and do-it-yourself outlets. And I know there's dozens of women on that street that have these little tiny storefronts, and they've mortgaged their houses, or they've maxed out $30,000 worth of credit cards, things like that, to try to start those businesses. And I don't really think that they're all doing so well. And so that leads to what a lot of people see as the next layer of gentrification on Alberta, which is frickin' Starbucks. You know, when as soon as a Starbucks pops up there, at this time, it's my understanding that there's not really any national franchise businesses there. Possibly there's a little Nextel phone outlet that's run by a couple Latina sisters there at, 19th and Alberta Street. But when Starbucks moves in, that's going to be like the next layer. And a lot of people have been mobilizing against specifically Starbucks hitting that street. And I just think that's really interesting, too, looking at the layers and looking at the role that city and state government has had in stifling culture and changing the culture there. So thanks a lot. That's all I wanted to say. I guess okay. That was a mouthful.
Okay. Thanks for
calling. I think we should probably talk about gentrification. Obviously a very delicate issue and some good things and some bad things with gentrification. We could look at a few neighborhoods. We could look at the neighborhood that was around Portland State that was the victim of a sort of a 50-60s style neighborhood redevelopment, which was just
call that urban removal.
Yeah, right. Just leveled. So yeah. All aspects of you know, local control and authenticity and culture just eliminated and people completely displaced. Where gentrification is slower, you know, you do have residents that participate in wealth creation, and you do have an Alberta Street like environment unfolding. But I think that as it unfolds, you know, the caller talked about some of the things that state and local government had done, and some of them very positive, low interest loans to promote locally owned business, women owned businesses. Promoting small-scale development, doing the kinds of street improvements that invite small-scale, more diffuse development. And in terms of people staying in the neighborhood, I think there are some things that are happening now in terms of community land trusts and publicly owned housing at fixed rents that that promote some more stability in the neighborhood and allow people the chance to stay in the neighborhood and maybe get a loan and start a business. So we're not in the old days now. We're in the new days when we still have a tremendous influx of, as Steve said, cultural creatives into Portland and tremendous kind of grassroots energy, I think, is still here to create artist collectives and open small performance spaces. But I think that we need to recognize that energy, but also apply some mechanisms that promote, you know, neighborhood stability and locally owned businesses and a more sustainable society and economy in our neighborhoods.
Well, I think the comment about the Starbucks, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking in the outskirts of Portland, and actually not so outskirts, because even in my neighborhood, we're fighting Walmarts. But the idea of starting to fight Starbucks, which is a mixed bag, because Starbucks, in terms of being an employer, is probably one of the better employers in the country, and they give a lot of money for very good causes. But there is the other...
And it was a hippie created.
Exactly. I mean, a very successful hippie created enterprise. Started out as a tea cart, tea and coffee cart in the Pike Street Market in Seattle, when that was not gentrified, when that was a real authentic farmer's market. And so that's one example of success, I guess. But I think that what the caller mentioned, which is a concern, that when a Starbucks moves into a neighborhood, it is often the sign of a certain kind of gentrification, which goes away from being the kind of locally owned, diverse, small business, locally owned orientation that Alberta now has, that Belmont Street still has. On the other hand, sometimes Starbucks can kind of kickstart a neighborhood. I mean, in my neighborhood, the thing that changed the corner of Bybee and Milwaukee was Starbucks. And this is before I moved in there, but a friend of mine was living there at the time who happens to be a historian, who gave me the history of Westmoreland. And he said before Starbucks moved in, it was just a neighborhood of bars. And I know some people feel very nostalgic for the old neighborhood bars, but and that was the thing about Alberta. Alberta at one time was a street where there were a few bars and a lot of empty buildings, many, many boarded up storefronts. And Selwood was just a bunch of bars and some really funky stores, and there was no sense of center at the corner of Bybee and Milwaukee. When Starbucks moved in, it just had enough leverage to really change that neighborhood, and then all these other mostly locally owned businesses have moved in, and it's become a very vibrant little business district, maybe a couple too many bridal stores, but...
yeah, why that?
Then
yeah.
We have two bridal stores and two children's toy stores, I guess.
I have to admit that I was responsible, in part, for gentrification in Northwest Portland, and...
You were.
Well, you know, what I guess I'm getting at is you don't see what's coming sometimes. Like, I was on the Northwest Neighborhood Board when Bud Clark and Margaret Strong were on it, and we, you know, brought money into Northwest Portland. I didn't recognize that the Singers were also on that board with me, and they were looking at the houses along 23rd and buying them. I was trying to rebuild the community. You know, so you go along, and I never expected Northwest 23rd to look like it did today. And I think there's invisible mechanisms that, you know, you can go in with full heart. We were, you know, but another, we were like, we wanted that neighborhood revitalized. You don't think of the outcome like 23rd, in effect, as the ultimate outcome. You just are trying to build community. And I think that's in Alberta, too. You know, there's a pattern in Portland, too, of Bill mentioned the earliest urban renewal area around Portland State. Well, if you look at the cause and effect of that migration, basically the Gypsy population, Jewish population, were moved out of that area, and the hippies and students of PSU were also moved out, and they all moved to Corbett, Twigger, Lair Hill. Well, then Lair Hill becomes a hotbed for the radical, and actually was probably the reason the neighborhood system was developed in Portland, because those people, Penny Allen, John Platt, other people that live there, you know, went in and said, we need to be able to review urban renewal plans. I mean, the Ira Kellers of the world wanted to basically destroy all of Corbett Twilliger. I mean, he thought of it as Appalachia. So the business leaders wanted to, you know, wipe out Corbett Twilliger neighborhood, the citizens who are now migrated over, you know, defended it and really helped do, kind of defended the Victorian housing stock of Portland, along with, a couple of hippie communes in Northeast Portland, Terra Squirma, and the learning community that was part of Reed College. They were the resettlers. But, you know, so here you have the
and
artists.
Southeast Portland with the...
And Southeast. And so you have these, the early, you know, the early urban pioneers are often hippies, artists, people who are willing to do that. And do we blame them for resettling the places that are most affordable and where there's good housing stock, or, you know, but they often come in after urban renewal efforts. I mean, Hawthorne wasn't really much infusion of public money for that redevelopment. That was almost all grassroots in a lot of ways.
And actually, Hawthorne, I mean, it's also sort of serendipity, because what sort of started Hawthorne and its road to the future was when the unfinished furniture store, which took the entire block between 36th and 37th, I think, and that closed down, and Bread and Ink Cafe took over part of it. And Bread and Ink Cafe was like a very different kind of thing for Hawthorne. And I know Kristen and I were both involved with the Women's Health Clinic, which used to be at 35th and Hawthorne, right across from 35th Place, back in the early 70s. And I would go over there every day to work at the clinic, and I'd be looking around at this funny neighborhood. And the one cultural icon in the neighborhood at that time was this little ice cream place across the street that was then... It was the Paper Moon was what it was called. Actually, before that, it was a pharmacy, and they had a really good soda fountain. And then the pharmacy closed down, but it became this kind of gift shop Paper Moon thing, and they still had really good ice cream. And that was about it for cultural. And then there was a really wacky shoe repair guy, Steve, who was sort of another kind of cultural icon. But most of that street was just like there was a used bookstore, which is now Powell's. And there were some other funny playthings and kind of thrift stores. And it was a very, like, a neighborhood waiting to happen.
Was the Baghdad Theater closed down?
No, the Baghdad Theater,
it was still there.
It was there, sort of, but it wasn't doing, it was in between, it showed movies, but it wasn't any place you'd go to.
Right.
And it was, of course, way before Do Jump Theater was there. And it was just kind of funny little places. But when Bread and Ink moved in, then Pasta Works moved across the street within a couple years. And it just takes a couple businesses, mm-hmm. and then it starts to blossom. And then Artichoke Music moved down the street a few more mm-hmm. years later and sort of started the urban pioneering of south of 33rd Street.
I think the last thing I'd add with that is just that what's really important to all of this, without understanding some of the mechanisms that Bill was talking about, I think are very important, but... We have in Portland an incredible political opportunity system. There's much more ways you can get involved in public policy than in most communities. But if you have that only, all the opportunity, without an underlying rich social capital in your community, which means these places like the concerts.
These alternative institutions.
Well, and places where people can gather without that political weight, where you can go to Tualatin and meet people you think are not like you. If a community doesn't have those places where people meet across divides on the air too, that's when things start declining. I mean, again, it's not speaking to a specific mechanism like urban renewal districts or whatever, and those are important to understand and work with. But if you don't have people being able to meet each other informally outside of a politicized context, I think you begin to get civic decline. You know, so we have to have those places in Alberta, wherever it is, where people can just see each other. Oh, we're all Portlanders, or we all have something in common. So those are very important, I think.
Maybe. I was going to say, maybe those are places that people can gather and brainstorm. It's where we can dream and we can mm-hmm. vision and we can sort of talk about what we think is going to happen or could happen, and then we have the cross-pollinization with other people who maybe come from slightly different background or have a different vision, and we can kind of put all that into the pot and stir it up. And I know that that's what Mountain Moving Cafe was, mm-hmm. as a place where that kind of talking happened, that kind of visioning of the future.
And actually, it seems like there isn't any place in Portland now, hasn't been for a long time, that's quite like Mountain Moving was, which actually only lasted for, what, 3 years?
Yeah.
And yet it's such an icon.
Huge. Yeah.
But it was a certain kind of gathering place that we are lacking. Now, I think what we have now are many small gathering places. Like, one of the places that seems to be there quietly is the Bijou Cafe, where I went to this amazing holiday concert just before New Year's. And with Rebecca Kilgore and Nancy King. And it was an amazing concert, and it was packed. And I've been to several events at the Bijou, and there it's again, it's just a privately owned small business, actually owned by women, that's been around as a real cultural institution in many ways. And it brings people from all over the city, as Mountain Moving also did. And it becomes a place that's much bigger than a place where you eat. It does seem that these places to gather, it's really good to have food there. I think
centered
if you're looking at
food, yeah.
But I wonder if it isn't time for Portland. I mean, the Bijou is pretty small. And I'm wondering if it isn't time to start thinking about building a cultural center that would basically probably be a restaurant, but in the way that the Contact Center and Arbuckle Flat was in the early 70s and Mountain Moving Cafe was in the late 70s.
But let me give you an example of a kind of place that exists and a kind of business and an example of the buzz in urban economic development now is authenticity, or a buzz is authenticity, which is, to me, a wonderful direction to be thinking in because it's about, you know, what is unique, what is local, what is special about a place in so many different ways, including that, you know, the types of businesses that emerge on Hawthorne and Belmont and when we support locally owned businesses. The McMinimans Empire is such to me a great example of what was a tiny locally owned business, a couple of homebrewer guys who sort of hit on something that took hold because of some unique characteristics of Portland. We like to drink beer and wine here. We are people that like to support unusual kind of businesses. So these guys have created these places now, and they've become more self-reflective about it along the way. And so they actually employ historians and artists on payroll and specialize in finding places like Edgefield and the Kennedy School and Cornelius Roadhouse, which really they're recycling history and they're creating places that people, in fact, do gather. I mean, the Kennedy School is as much a community center as it is, you know, a business,
and that's
in the way that the community uses it.
And that's actually for a community that has just been overlooked by most of mainstream. I mean, it's in a low-income community.
Cornelius.
What?
Cornelius, you mean?
No, Kennedy School.
Oh, Kennedy.
I mean,
in
Concordia.
Yeah.
And, I mean, a neighborhood that now at least it has a supermarket. But, I mean, it was a really underserved neighborhood. And when I went to Kennedy School, I was very impressed to see that the pool is free for the neighbors. And it is, in many ways, serving
all kinds of
the Neighborhood Association has a room there that they use. And when we have the concert committee meet, we use that room sometimes. And McMinimans does, in many ways, serve that purpose. And the thing that I also am impressed about them is that as a grassroots business that grew up in Portland, they also give back to the community in pretty significant ways. They offer nonprofits opportunities to use their facilities as fundraisers to generate money. And they, you know, they do what they call a friends and family night. It's a really great thing. And you can go in there with an organization like a concert committee and raise money for your organization through that evening.
And they're a great employer. And in fact, my nephew he still works a little bit for McMinimans, but he came to Portland, was working a couple of lousy bar jobs, landed at Crystal Ballroom and then the Annex, Ringler's Annex.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they treat their employees, I mean, he's got health insurance. And he also has been able to travel all around the world because he gets leaves of absence. And I don't know anybody else who works any other bar you can work at, we get an unpaid leave of absence. Come back and get your job. And I think that they recognize that there is a class of young people who are creative, who are restless, who want to have a lot of flexibility in their lives, and who also are really good workers. And that the way you keep them is you allow them to, okay, mm-hmm. You want to go off for 3 months to Thailand here, you know, and you can have your job when you come back. And I think it's a very different kind of employer that I think reflects, again, a different kind of cultural sensitivity. That
another one like that in the food systems, or the food systems of Portland has really reached a tipping point in terms of farmers market and CSAs and everything. And so food is this central issue in this. New Seasons, Brian Reuter was telling me that he's thinking of implementing a new program at the Selwood, at least, or probably the other ones too, the stores they had in Arcadia in California, in one of those locally owned stores there. That is, that you can wear Groucho Marx mask as you walk in the door if you don't want to talk to people. And I thought, you know, that's an indicator of rich social capital. And even those food stores, I mean, New Seasons for me in Selwood is that experience. If I walk in there even, and I never even knew my community was so rich in people like me, in effect, until that opened, you know, because there was an old Kino's there. And now it's like I walk in there and I do feel like sometimes, okay, I'm going to wear a mask so that I don't get into all these conversations if I don't want to. I want to shop. But one other comment I want to make is I think the change since the 1970s is you know, we thought of ourselves as Portland, and now really increasingly it's Portland region. And the power of Washington County and the other suburbs in my growing up has just totally transformed politics and culture in the Portland area. When I drive out to the suburbs, like I tried to get to the Nike campus once to give a talk not too long ago, I get stressed. I get really, like, I do not understand non-grid work. I do not understand. I mean, I get out there and I just feel like a stranger in a strange land, you know, and I feel, and I know that's irrational in a way, too. And I go, like, well, this must be the way people feel like when they move into, drive from the suburbs and push down their lock knobs as they move into Northeast Portland because they're fearful and they're you know, they don't
or
know
encounter
what,
the one-way grid in downtown.
Right.
So do you lock your doors when you get into Washington County?
No, but what I do is I sat there and I was trying to figure out how these people were getting. I couldn't read street addresses. I didn't know how to get to where I was going, you know. And I suddenly saw this woman in a station wagon go bumping across parking lot to parking lot. And I went, oh, I get it. You just got to go, I guess. You know? So I just went. But what it got me thinking about was the need to do some TV show in Portland, or maybe, okay, we could do it like Trading Places. You know, like we would actually, I'd go out and live in a non-grid suburban area to try to understand. And I'm joking, but I'm also saying, you know, one of our tests right now is we are not just Portland.
Yeah.
You know, the population and the power has shifted a lot from when I was growing up. And if we don't get that, we're going to keep losing major political battles. We can't isolate ourselves from the politics of the region. And it's one of our biggest challenges right now, I think.
I actually want to let people know that you are listening to KBOO, and this is the Whole Communities Radio Project. We're having a special panel this morning about the role that cultural development plays in creating sustainable, healthy communities. And we just heard from Steve Johnson, which I think will sort of segue nicely into talking about creating how the built community, what kind of built communities you need to sustain the kind of culture that we want and how the two things work together. Kristen Aspen, who's been involved for 25 years or more with Portland Park's concerts, and in the last, I don't know, 10 years, you moved out to Tualatin, too,
yeah,
and started
12,
work.
13.
I think they need you more in Washington County, perhaps, to help. And Bill Bulick, who has been doing a lot of cultural development consulting in his days since he was an arts administrator and earlier a potter and Irish musician and music store owner at Artichoke Music. And I think we have some calls. If you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 25 minutes before 9 o'clock. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I was born and raised in Portland, and so I was born, I'm 68 now, so I remember downtown Portland in the 1940s, and I've been through a lot of these same battles. I was one of the people who signed on for the Kennedy School of Neighborhood Association over, which is Cully. But one of the biggest changes I've seen over the years is all these out-of-state ownership. And so, you know, Myron Franks was owned in Portland and was a family run, and they used to have a lot of things within the store and used to do a lot of things for the community. Well, now, of course, again, and so it's owned, I think, out of New York City. The art museum was free until, I think, 1970. And there were, by the way, clear back in the 1940s and 1950s, there were things in the parks. Now, there was this lull period when a lot of these areas went into decline in the 50s and early 60s, so some of you who came here in the 1960s didn't know what was going on in the 1940s. Of course, the population was much smaller, radically smaller. But I can remember going downtown in the late 1940s to take my music lesson at the Fine Arts Building and then would go up to the art museum, and even when I was like 10, 12 years old, I could go downtown by myself, and my mother never worried about that because it was not a problem. So there's been a lot of changes. But I see one of the biggest things is that so much of the business community is no longer owned in Portland, and so is the neighborhood associations. I have to work harder. And by the way, the first coordinator was in North Portland. A friend of mine by the name of Jerry Mounts was the first neighborhood coordinator, and that was just to get some help. Now we have great institutions with the coalitions. I've been on the Southeast Uplift Board. I have I have been involved in forming two different neighborhood associations. But the one thing that I see very often when you get into the suburbs, and even like out here by the airport, which is where I live because I've always lived in Cully, is that a lot of the people just don't seem to care about culture, because why they came out to this part of town was to get away from the city. And so although this is an area with larger lots, they like to do things on their own property and don't seem to care a lot about what's going on on a cultural basis in other parts of the city. So I would just like to comment that I think one of the biggest impacts has been the out-of-state ownership. And then don't ask me about the PDC and some of the havoc that they have wrecked in various parts of town and setting people up into business that they are unable in the long run. In the really old days, in the early 1900s, people had a shop because they lived in back with their family, and they had to make that shop work because that was their total source of income. They didn't have to rely on other things. But I think it's a wonderful thing, and without culture, you can't have a community. Thanks.
Sure, thanks for calling. And we got another couple callers we'll take before we get back into I think we want to look a little bit at the connections between sprawl, perhaps, and the difficulty of having sustainable culture. But we'll take our next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, you got another geezer. I'm born in 1938, Manual Hospital, Irvington Grade School. Grew up on Northeast 20th. I saw The Third Man in 1950 at the Irvington Theater. I remember that. But, you know, I just wanted to respond to something a previous caller called up about, that what's the bureaucracy called that controls alcohol?
OLCC.
OLCC. I really question that they closed down some of the bars there in North Portland due to racism. I really do. They closed down bars all over the place, in white neighborhoods too. They respond. I don't work for them. I don't work for the state, but they respond to neighbor complaints about prostitution, stabbings, shootings, burglaries that are related to these bars. You know, that's basically it. I really don't think there's much of any racism involved in it. But getting back to the culture, in a very broad sense, I, of course, change is inevitable, but when you get older, you kind of hate to see it. I grew up with there was something called the Pacific International Livestock Exposition. It reflected the cultural values of the time, of course, and the economy. It was a big deal, I tell you. Politicians, judges, they had a big dance. I think they called it a ball. It might have been downtown Portland, actually, but people would show up. Actually, they would show up out at the PI building, dressed in their in tuxedos and gowns. I guess they tried to stay away from the stalls pretty much. But Portland was, it was a lively place. I remember in 1948 there was a women's softball team from Portland won the national championship. It was sponsored by Irvine Flores. There's just all kinds of really exciting stuff going on, but not the kind of stuff that you're talking about, basically. But the Portland Beaver baseball team. Portland was a big baseball team. Now, I don't want to see big league baseball here, frankly, but Triple A baseball was big.
Okay, I'm actually going to have you wind up because we got some more callers and we got to keep going.
Well, okay. Well, do you think that Portland should do a complaint? What about porno shops and strip joints, so-called laundry places? I mean, does this have a place in our culture? Portland's got a reputation for being the most per capita, having the most of those kind of. I mean.
Okay, actually, I think we're really getting off topic, so I think we're going to go back to where we're going. So anyway, thanks for calling. I think that we'll kind of skip that last comment and kind of start where Steve was going about being lost in suburbia. And I want to talk a little bit about the infrastructure of a community and how that really can help cultural development in the same ways that cultural development can help the infrastructure of the city. And I think that the caller who lived out in Cully Street was sort of describing, we started talking about these large lots, people kind of hang out in their own houses and don't mingle with their neighbors and don't have a whole lot of interest in culture. It does seem to be the cliche that we have about suburbs and sort of the ex-urban areas and the edges of town, that it's harder to have a cultural sense a cultural fabric that permeates those communities as it does when you are in a grid and you have more population density. And Bill, in your work, do you find that there is a link that you see between the way that a community is designed and the way that a cultural fabric comes together?
There are certainly people choose to participate or not. Planning is part of infrastructure, too, and I was thinking about another first for Portland, which was when we unfolded a community culture planning process in the late 80s here, we decided for a variety of reasons to do what ended up being the first truly regional culture planning process of a major U.S. city in the U.S., and we had a lot of precedents to reinforce regional dialogue and regional collaboration, but it was not easy. And there were several things that came out of that, including a regional cultural agency and the fostering of culture in all throughout the region. But one of the things that we found was that in joining this dialogue, that we discovered all the things that are happening throughout the region that people in downtown Portland tend to not know about. You know, the Beaverton Arts Commission actually is as old as the Metropolitan Arts Commission, and cultural activity thrives throughout the region. The reason for planning, I think, is to give voice to what was a very strong sentiment, and that is that people are interested in cultural activity that's local to them, and they want to support it, and they want to develop it. And yet, when we think of regional collaboration, we try to create dialogue that reinforces complementary cultural activity and appropriately scaled, so that one would hope that not every community would not want or feel the need either to build major performing arts facilities or gigantic institutions, that those institutions, if it makes sense that they're centered in downtown Portland, would serve the region. But the activity also sparked a lot of cultural development. So you have communities like Tualatin and Hillsboro is doing incredible things now in terms of trying to create a town center and really use cultural activity and social capital formation, farmers markets and a new public plaza and programmed activity in that plaza and the development of a cultural arts center in Hillsboro to really, you know, spark development and sense of community there. So it is happening all over, but people want both locally generated examples and opportunities to participate, as well as hopefully participating in some things that have regional impact.
Well, I think they also, the caller talked about the need for locally owned businesses and the role that plays in generating really healthy cultural life. And I think that it kind of goes back to what Kristen was talking about, getting the business partners involved with the Parks concert series in all the neighborhoods. And is there a way that we can help to encourage the growth of and even the survival of locally owned business here, the whole concept of keeping Portland weird, as opposed to this, the Starbucksization and Walmartization of our community?
I think we probably have to make a better case for why local is good, and I don't think we've really done that well yet. I mean, you ask people, you know, they feel like it should be, but it's a different issue to really convince business leaders, et cetera, that there is something. What's the multiple levels of good?
But the Burnside Bridgehead dialogue, I think, was a very interesting tipping point. So you had a neighborhood with
Division Street,
you know, mm-hmm. some sentiment to bring a big box in, a kind of development RFP process controlled by PDC. Has in the past typically been fairly closed process. The big developers, you know, win the prize, but neighborhood activism, people got involved, kind of really tipped the sentiment about what should happen there. In the end, the big local, largely out of town owned developer did get the project, but by modifying to produce a much more an aggregation of much more small-scale type development and was asked and is now partnering with the local company.
That thought the whole thing up to begin with.
It is resident in that neighborhood. And so, you know, a very interesting tipping point for the community in terms of how we think about districts and neighborhoods and how we want to develop them. There will definitely not be a big box there.
Yeah. Another good example, I think, of the Chefs Collaborative in terms of a group that's trying to understand and work with that, so you look at it from multiple levels of impact, you know, so it's not just, in that case, organic, but it's local, and it's even good, smart union outlook, Food Alliance that regulates that, so that you it's a multiple package of activities you're looking at in terms of how businesses are developed locally.
And you mentioned New Seasons earlier, and I think that's another example of a store that's not just locally owned, but they have a big movement within the store to buy locally produced produce, but then a lot of other stuff, and that they have the homegrown logo now, which they've developed, which marks anything that they are promoting within the store that is within, you know, kind of walking distance, or at least mental walking distance of where that store is. And one of the things I really like about New Seasons is when you walk in and they have a map of where your meat comes from, or where your vegetable comes from versus where it would in Safeway. And this meat was grown down in Roseburg, whereas in Safeway that meat would have been grown in Argentina or Australia or something. And to also understand all the mechanisms of what it takes when we have a global economy feeding us, that how much it costs in terms of energy consumption, and as well as the fact, and fertilizer and preservatives and all the other things that are used to, that are petroleum-based, that are used to create this food that came from halfway around the world to feed you.
I think New Seasons is a great example of a company that has reinvested back into the community, too. I mean, they've come into neighborhoods, sometimes very depressed neighborhoods like Concordia, and put a shop there. And I remember one woman from that neighborhood I talked with, who was on one of my committees, said, I'll never be able to afford to shop there. I can't go there. You know, this. I don't know why they're coming here. And she was like totally down on it. And I think now that they have joined the concert committee sponsorship list, and they've reinvested back in the neighborhood in so many other ways and do benefits for groups and nonprofits, I think that they have really turned people's heads around in terms of how they feel about shopping locally, because they see that it may cost more, but A, they're getting better food, and B, they're supporting something that's supporting them.
And also the doctor bills may go down quite a bit if they're actually eating.
And so food. It becomes part of our cultural value system, and it in turn influences, and it's kind of what we're talking about, is culture is the underlying agent in these examples. And it influences public policy. I mean, the fact that we have the highest recycling rate in the country, and that we're about to move into being able to recycle food waste is springing from this cultural value of taking care of the earth and thinking locally.
Well, I'm going to try to squeeze one more phone caller in here. Let's see, and hopefully this person will be a little more on topic than the last caller. But hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to bring up the subject of the Portland Art Museum that... with all the hoopla of the development, we went down to see the pictures, and I never saw so much junk in my life. And I thought, if this is the cultural scene and it's being developed in Portland, I don't want any part of it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. Well, I think actually what we're talking about today is exactly the opposite of that. I mean, I think...
Well, there are examples of major institutions here and elsewhere that really can open their doors to the community and get out in the community. The Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis is a fabulous example of that in terms of really engaging with community around contemporary art and being a force in neighborhoods and so on.
Well, actually, I think that the Portland Art Museum may be in a position of being forced to change, too, because even the Oregonian, there was an article that talked about, compared all these museums in cities the size of Portland and larger, how many free days they had, how many low-cost days they had. Portland is one of the most expensive art museums in the country and one of the least engaged in the community at this point. So I think that if it's percolated up to the Oregonian, this kind of discontent with the Portland Art Museum, they may be forced to start becoming more responsive to the community.
Well, some of the other large cultural institutions are sort of more active in the community. And I think of OBT Exposed and how you can go for free and watch the dancers work for a week. And I think that's fabulous.
But the concerts you're doing are wonderful. I remember being out in Lentz, where I worked for many years during the urban renewal districting of that area, and actually going out to a park when there was a concert there and looking around and going, I mean, I'm clicheing people and I can do that because I lived out there, okay. But, you know, it's like I expect to see a bunch of beer cans, people, and instead, you know, it's like, wow, they're all listening to Bach or whatever. We're sitting in this park, and it just changed the feeling of that neighborhood, you know, to be there in this peaceful setting with these people and sharing this whole other thing than you know, going to the Copper Penny and playing the lottery or something. So, I mean, it plays a huge role, I think, in terms of, again, creating a different civic story and having a different sense of who you are as a community when you can have these kind of public events.
And it is still very tenuous in places like Lentz in terms of finding funding. There was a year we had to skip having concerts there. And so I'm just putting it out. I want to put out to the airwaves that all of the concerts need sponsorship, you know, and need local businesses to support them. So when we ask you, I hope that you'll step up.
Well, we just got a couple more minutes left, so I wonder if people want to just kind of go around and have some parting thoughts about how we can continue to improve the cultural fabric of Portland, and what maybe final thought about what it is about Portland as it's actually maintained a lot of its historic infrastructure, which I think we're starting, the new urbanism is coming back to realizing, yes, the grid works, and the way that downtown Portland was structured with small block lengths, these things work. This structure keeps people walking. But how can we continue to have a cultural life here that makes use of what Portland has and really helps to sustain what's worked in Portland and make more of that?
Well, I guess I'd like to end by just throwing out an idea that I've got going, and that is to get artists involved in the next round of discussions about land use. We have just a huge defining issue for our state, and we also have a lot of artists in this community and around the state who have done work that is about engaging public dialogue on public policy issues and or pointing out options or confronting some of the challenges in our public realm. And I think there's a wonderful opportunity for us to have a more creative, hopefully more inspiring dialogue about an issue that could hardly be more important.
I would just add that I really back what Bill said, and I think that I love wonks. I love policy wonks. They're some of my best friends. But, you know, if we leave it to them only, it really in land use problems we have right now, I think arts and culture are going to play a vital role to get us down to our humanity level about who we are and how we live together.
Explore our values.
Exploring our values has to be done before we get to the policy wonk level of, like, do we need this regulation or not this regulation? All very important, but we need what Bill's talking about.
And I think that an institution like the Summer Concerts in the Parks is a great place where we can bring together multicultural culture. We can have music of lots of Southeast Asia, of Africa, of all the immigrant communities, of the old communities that have been here for a long time, and we can all enjoy and share that together in an open setting where there's not an expectation, and children and families can all be there together. And I just encourage people to get involved on whatever level it appeals to you, you know, as an audience member, as a sponsor, as an artist, to, you know, participate. And in participating, you'll find a way to have a voice and to help build the future.
Well, I want to thank Bill Bulick, Steve Johnson, and Kristen Aspen for joining us today. This has been another presentation of the Whole Communities Radio Project, which is sponsored by Community Partners for Sound Partners for Community Change. Wait, try again. What is the name of our sponsor? They're going to like this. Sound Partners for Community Health, and also the Oregon Council for the Humanities, which is providing some of the funding for some of our community events. We're in partnership with the Coalition for a Livable Future. And next month we're going to be talking about the Equity Atlas, which is a project of the Coalition for a Livable Future, and the role that plays in sort of mapping social and economic and cultural and environmental equity in this region, and how different neighborhoods have more advantage or less advantage. So that'll be coming up. I'm going to be out of town for the next couple weeks, and I'll be back on February 7th or February 8th with some great stories from Venezuela. We're going to, before we go out, with some music by Linda Ronstadt and Emmy Lou Harris, just want to let you know that coming up on KBOO at 9 o'clock, Veterans Voice, Vets for Peace, discuss some of the newly released material from the NSA on the Gulf of Tonkin. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller features updates related to some recent programs and other news. At 10:30, Per Fagering interviews Richard Heimberg, author of Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, topics include remembering the legacy of Eugene McCarthy and a look at the life of Hugh Thompson, the former Army helicopter pilot who helped stop the My Lai massacre in 1968. Tonight on Circle A Radio looks at a history of U.S. government surveillance programs. And again, we're going to go up with some music by Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris. Stay tuned for The Vets in just a few moments.
Western Wall, maybe a little of that wall stands inside of us all. I shove my prayers in the crack. I got nothing to lose, no one to answer back. All these years I brought up for review. Wasn't taught this, but I learned something new. And to answer a distant call at the Western Wall. I got a heart full of fear, and I offer it up on this altar of tears. Red dust settles deep in my skin. I don't know where it's where I begin. It's a crumbling pile of broken stone. It ain't much, but it might be home. If I ever loved a place at all, it's the Western his fall near the Western Wall.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and it's time for Veterans Voice. That's coming right up, and at 10 o'clock, as Barbara read you, People Rise Up with Andrew Geller, featuring updates related to some recent programs and some other news. At 10:30, Per Fagering will be here interviewing Richard Heimberg. His new book, Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. And at 11 o'clock, Democracy Now! Topics include remembering the legacy of Eugene McCarthy and a look at the life of Hugh Thompson, the former Army helicopter pilot who helped stop the My Lai massacre in 1968. And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, followed at 6 by Circle A Radio, featuring a look at the history of U.S. government surveillance programs with guest Professor Brian Glick, author of The War at Home, Covert Actions Against U.S. Activists and What We Can Do About It, and Lauren Regan of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. And here come...